Live from London, this is The Late Show with Noreen Khalid on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good evening. It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 8th of September. I'm Noreen Khalid, your host on The Late Show, and we are live on Teachers Talk Radio. On tonight's show, I have the very wonderful Martin Robinson as my guest. We will be talking about culture and curriculum and lots more. Stay with us for what promises to be a very interesting hour and a half.
Live from London, this is The Late Show with Noreen Khalid on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
A very warm welcome to you all. Great to have you with me. This is your show, so do join in with me and my guest by calling in or texting or using social media. If this is your first time tuning in, or you would just like to find out more, then please head over to our website, www.ttradio.org. If you have thought about hosting a radio show of your own, but didn't know where to start, then our website has details about how to get in touch with us. The team will be delighted to hear from you, and you may become our latest host with a show of your own. My guest tonight is Martin Robinson. He's having slight problems joining in, so we'll just wait for him to join in. For some reason, his app is telling him it's pending approval. So I hope he'll be able to sort that out quickly and join in. Martin, if you are listening in, just try and download the app again. Hopefully that should work. Well, till Martin joins in, a bit of background about him. Martin is an education consultant with an interest in liberal arts. He's also an author, and his books Trivium 21C and Curriculum Athena vs. the Machine have been really well received. So we'll wait till Martin joins us. It'll be quite an honor for us to have Martin when he does. When the technology lets us have a chat with Martin. I'll just message Martin to see where he's got to. I'm going to ask him to see if he can get in touch with one of our other team members who can help him download the app or hopefully get on the. Well, you can't multitask. Although I'm a woman, I can't multitask. I was just DMing Martin, asking him to DM Tom Rogers. Oh, thank you, Tom. Tom's just texted that he's messaged him. So thank you for that, Tom. That's what's great about Teachers Talk Radio. There's always somebody around to help you. So if you are a new host, or if you are thinking of starting a show, thinking of becoming a host, but have never done this before, so really there is nothing to be worried about. This is the first time I've done a podcast, and I've had so much help from the team. You know, if something goes wrong, you just ring them or message them, and there's always somebody there to help you. So if you do want to start a show or thinking of hosting one, if you've got some great ideas about what you'd like to talk to teachers about, do give the team a message and see about that. It would be lovely to have it. Martin, now when did I meet Martin last? Well, that was on Saturday actually, when we were at Research Ed on Saturday near Stratford. Now Martin had the last slot. He was speaking on in session 5, which is the slot after lunch. So having attended the sessions before that, I got there about just after 9. My own session was just after lunch. And you would think that, you know, the last session, your attention is flagging, you are getting a bit tired, it's the end of the day, you've just had lunch. And so you might not be able to to pay that much attention to the last show. But that wasn't the case with Martin. Martin is a really, really engaging speaker. He held the room, he held everybody's attention, and it was really interesting to listen to him. So, in fact, I would suggest anybody who does presentations or who talks at conferences, so if you do get a chance to go and listen to Martin, do that, because I think that's a masterclass in how to do a session, how to hold the room, how to work the room. So it's really lovely. So research Ed, what else did I do besides Martin? I attended Amanda Spearman's speech. Now that has been published, so you must have seen about that speech. I quite like Amanda, and I think she is just what Ofsted needs and needed. So I'm really glad that we've got Amanda as the HMCI. She talked about the subject reviews, it was good to hear from Amanda from Ofsted side what they hoped to achieve from the subject reviews, why they were doing it. She also talked about the work they had done on sexual abuse. And if you haven't read that report, that's one to read as well. She also mentioned the governance review, which I was, whenever I'm at a conference, unless it's a governance conference, if you go to any other teaching conference, if somebody mentions governance, that really excites me and that really makes me happy being a governor myself. So she mentioned governance, which was really good. So Amanda's speech was good. And the thing about Amanda is she doesn't just come in, give her speech and go back. She stays for the day. She listens, she goes in, drops in on the other sessions, takes notes, asks questions, discusses, talks with other teachers and everybody else who's there. So it feels quite nice. You don't feel that you can't go up to Amanda and question her. And she's quite open to challenge. You can ask her anything you like. But just the fact that she comes along to these conferences, and it's not only research that she's gone to. I know of other conferences where Amanda goes and listens to people. I think it's really good for people to, for people who are in Ofsted to be able to talk to people who are in who are at the right. I think Martin is here. I'm just trying to see if I can. Right, I'm inviting Martin. I've sent him an invite. He is a listener, so I think that is Martin. I've sent him. Hello.
Hello, is that me?
I think that's you, Martin.
God, what a nightmare.
Well, it happens. I was just telling people about how what you do, and the fact that the last time I saw you was this Saturday gone, and although you had the last session, which was the graveyard slot, but it didn't feel like that. It was really, really interesting, and you held our attention really well. And so I've said to people, if anybody wants a masterclass about how to do a good presentation, they should go in and listen to you.
So Martin Robinson, not as bad as a graveyard.
No, not bad at all. No.
So I like a good graveyard.
Well, actually, I do too. They aren't creepy. And if you go well, in the middle of the night, perhaps, but not during the day. I quite like reading the inscriptions, and some of them are so personal. And you think about the person who's lying there, and the family, and you wonder whether that inscription was something the person whose grave is. Did he decide on that himself, or was that something which has come from the family? So I think listeners who know me know that my father sadly passed away in 2018. What we've put on his gravesite is a couplet in Persian, which was one of his really favorite ones, and he used to recite that quite a lot to us. And so we've had that engraved there for him. because for us that, you know, that just that was him. So that's graveyards. So yes, no, it's not. I don't think they're gravy. They are creepy at all. Right. Before we start chatting to you, Martin, I've just got two announcements to make for my listeners. Firstly, Teachers Talk Radio is doing a book giveaway. So all you have to do is head over to our Twitter page, TT Radio 2021, follow us and retweet the pinned tweet. The deadline is 12th of September, when one winner will be chosen randomly and they will own three fabulous books. And secondly, for the next 7 days, our hosts, including me, may be dropping an ABBA reference during the show. So as soon as you hear it, text the word ABBA into the show, and the first person to do so will win the fabulous TTR Teachers Talk Radio mug as well as a badge. So there you go. So listen out for an ABBA reference, which may be coming up during the show. So Martin,
does that mean I can do ABBA references?
You can if you want to. Yes.
Well, that screw everything up if I do them though.
No, it wouldn't. As long as you do it before me, that'd be the first time anybody said it, so that's fine.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Before midnight.
During the show.
Right. But yeah. No man after midnight, of course.
No man like after midnight.
Anyway, no. Yeah. Keep going.
Okay. So, Martin, tell us a bit about yourself. How did you get into teaching?
I got into teaching when I was 29. Mm-hmm. It was either that or becoming an advertising space salesperson.
Right.
And which I was doing at the time. And I got, I think it was, what do you call it when you're quite good at something and someone comes across you and headhunted, that's the word.
Headhunted, yes.
Yeah, I got headhunted by The Guardian, who wanted me to go and work for them.
Why?
To sell advertising, particularly for the unions, mm-hmm. and sell space to the labour movement, et cetera, et cetera. They thought I'd be good at that. And I decided I didn't want to be an advertising space salesperson and decided on a careers change and looked for a PGC course at Goldsmiths in South London on drama,
mm-hmm.
and a bit of English, but mainly drama.
Right.
And that was it. So 29 right. years old, that's what happened.
The rest is history.
Well, yeah. The rest is drama.
The rest of drama, yes. Drama, do you think it gets neglected with the emphasis on STEM, etc.?
Drama has been neglected ever since I started teaching it. It was neglected when I was at school because mm-hmm. it wasn't a subject. So
yes.
that's
yes.
peculiarly neglected. And when I started teaching, it was a couple of GCSEs and there was an A-level as well. But the A-level was theatre studies and the GCSEs were community theatre and drama, and they were all very different pedagogically and philosophically, but I had great fun.
Right. So what do we need to do to make drama more, bring it at par with STEM subjects?
I mean, where to start? I mean, it should be up there with art and music,
mm-hmm.
And it's in a more similar space to dance, I suppose. And dance yes. is the poorer cousin of drama, and drama is the poorer cousin to music
yeah.
and art. Both music and art are on the national curriculum.
Yeah,
drama isn't, but yeah. to some extent, that has been quite freeing for drama teachers. It means that you had to create your own curricula from all the, you weren't following anything per se. So that freedom has been good for some drama teachers, more difficult for others, I expect. And for me, I really relished the freedom to do my own thing, so to speak. And obviously, though, you have to take notice of the exams that you have to teach as well.
Yes.
Which I loved teaching drama as a as an exam subject. But in those days, it was freer in that it was more practical. And now, because of the iniquities of the exam system, I suppose, in other words, you have to be more objective in your grading.
Yes.
It's become more and more written work, and which I think is a great shame in some ways, but I can see why it's got there. So it's gone from, it's about 70 to 80% of it now is written work at GCSE, which I think is a bit crazy.
Okay.
Instead of about 70 to 80% practical when I was teaching it. So that gives you some idea of the change.
I suppose
so it's become, so for all the kids who enjoy farting about in tights, with a bit of slap on their face and having a laugh, it's become a rather more of a drier, more academic subject, which I suppose there's nothing wrong with that for dry academic subjects, but for, you would hope on the in the curriculum there'll be a space for farting about in tights.
And the written bit, how do you have to have really good, are you assessed on your English writing skills?
You are for everything. So you've got to write well. You've got to structure your arguments well, and you've got to know what you're talking about.
Right.
You've got to know about the theatre, and you've got to know about playwrights and plays. And you've got to know about practitioners. So in the case, a classic one, Bertolt Brecht. Yeah. If you write about Brecht, you've also got to know about Marxism and aesthetic theory.
Yeah.
And also Aristotelian theatre and Stanislavskian theatre and why he objected to those types of theory, all sorts of things. So you do have to know a great deal of theory, which you should know anyway if you're a practitioner of the art, but you have to write about it in a lot more detail, whereas in the past, like I said, you could use those practitioners more in your art, making your art, but you are still making art. I mean, there's still a very important part of the final pieces, final exams. But
I suppose one thing which may have helped during the lockdown and online teaching was that because of this imbalance in the practical and the written work, they didn't suffer much. I'd like to think what would have happened if they still were assessed on 80% of practical work and nobody could go in to do anything.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, but you shouldn't
judge it in extraordinary times.
Exactly, exactly. Hopefully, we'll never have a pandemic again.
Well, I'm sure we will, but hopefully, it doesn't close schools down so easily. It's taken a hit, obviously, because the last thing you can do, in the pandemic is get loads of kids in a room singing and dancing and hugging and working together in close proximity, making plays for an audience who are packed in as well. But thankfully theatres have come back and hopefully drama in schools is going to go from strength to strength. But it has been hit by the reforms. And obviously the EBAC, I think, was one of those reforms that did for drama. And I mean, numbers taking drama have gone down both at GCSE and at A level. And that kind of coincides with the EBAC becoming a thing. And there, I have the figures, but not to hand. I have the figures and it is... certainly taken a hit. And, you know, I mean, English literature at A level is now sort of losing numbers. It used to be the most popular.
Mm-hmm.
And now maths is the most popular.
Okay.
So I think STEAM, the idea of education for the world of work and for earning, has become more of a thing. And the arts subjects are, you know, I don't want to say they're all in decline because I haven't got the figures for that.
Yeah.
But I expect that there is some sort of correlation with the EBAC, but also with people going to university to get better jobs. You know, you've got to pay your way through university, and the whole change around, if you like, has probably made a difference there. Because the arts, you know, the arts only make loads of money for very few, but you can make loads of money out of them as well. But
you mentioned STEAM. I've always got a problem with STEAM. To me, it seems really contrived, as if you're trying to shoehorn the arts into STEM. What do you think about that?
Well, I think STEM is nonsense in the first place.
So,
Before you get into STEAM. I mean, STEM, technology has disappeared in lots of schools, or has become, you know, far less of a thing than it used to be. Engineering, I've never seen much engineering going on in most schools, but there might be a bit going on. So we're basically, you haven't got the T and the E there, so you're basically left with S and M, which is rather an unfortunate as acronym.
Yes, we won't go there. Moving on now, let's talk about curriculum and decolonization, etc. What do you think when people say the curriculum needs to be decolonized? What do you think they're asking for?
Blimey. you've gone into something there. I think there's a wide range of things that people are asking for under the banner of decolonization.
Right.
And I think there are arguments going on there about what people mean by decolonization. And to me, it's difficult to see exactly what is meant without getting embroiled in some sort of culture war argument. Because you've got people on one side talking about whiteness, talking about white fragility and all these sorts of things, and people on the other side denying that the curriculum is colonized in the first place.
That's
so you can look at, a particularly in America, where a lot of the movements for decolonization gathered pace, that loads of the arguments come over here. I think it's got caught up in something that people arm themselves on the barricades before they really look at the possibilities of what's being said. And I have a few views about what's being said. And one of those is, I mean, I think it's David Olusoga who put it like the phrase, I'm going to try and remember what he said, but the phrase decolonize the curriculum, I think he called it hostage to fortune.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't think the phrase has much traction.
Mm-hmm.
But what he does say is what you're trying to get from it is make the curriculum tell everyone's stories to have a wider perspective and perspectives upon things. And I think that is rather sensible. So if you look at from one angle, it's highly caught up in the culture wars. But if you sort of let off that side of things and just try and look at what it might be about, it might be opening out things to more stories, to more angles, to more ways of thinking about things. And I think that can only be a good thing for a curriculum.
Would diversification be a better thing? It's you know, asking for diversification rather than decolonizing. Would that be better?
There's two words. There's multiculturalism,
yes,
and diversity. And what generally both those do, one thing, multiculturalism tends to imply that we're all in static cultures,
mm-hmm,
and there's a lot of them, and that you're in that bit, I'm in this bit, someone else is over there in that bit, and we are all together doing things completely separately, or, you know, but there's some sort of rainbow, but the rainbow colors are completely sort of delineated from each other. Mm-hmm. Diversity smacks something of company boards, and we have to have a number of people of who are perhaps white, a number of people who are women, number of people who are BAME,
yeah,
and we'll come to that perhaps, and some who are gay, some who are trans, or whatever, you know, we have, yeah, a diverse number of people here who we take on their identity and say that is diverse. Now, to me, neither of those help us particularly. Mm-hmm. What does help us is having some sort of way of looking at things from different perspectives. So I would use, and I'm sorry every time I use this philosopher, because it's Nietzsche, because people sort of associate him with sort of teenage bedrooms and people are sort of getting into their first philosopher. But Nietzsche talks about perspectivism,
mm-hmm,
and it's opening different perspectives out, and it's the content of what's being said that really does matter. And if you're talking about the British Empire, for example, there is, you know, the history I was taught about the British Empire was very much our island story sort of thing, you know, the Great British Empire. And unfortunately, the word great is has a double meaning. It's not just the biggest island, the Great Britain. It's the Great British Empire. And sort of two-thirds of the world were pink on the globe and things like that or whatever. But of course, you have to have the fullness of stories. It's you can imagine if the, and some people might be upset with this analogy, but you can imagine if the Nazis had won the Second World War, mm-hmm, and the Holocaust was never taught in schools,
mm-hmm, yeah,
because it was wiped out of history, you know, and I think that wouldn't tell you the whole truth.
Yeah.
So you must, with teaching the British Empire, you must teach about the concentration camps, the looting and pillaging and raping, the wiping out of local cultures and drawing the maps and doing all sorts of nefarious things that the were done in the name of the British Empire, you know. And so you have to teach colonialism. I think it only opens up the stories to a wider public, and it tells the truth more. It tells the truth about empire, but the, you know, you put it in context of other empires as well.
Yeah.
So the Roman Empire, the Aztec Empire, or whatever, the Ottoman Empire. You know, you can look at empires from around the world, right, and compare and contrast, and things like slavery. You can look at slavery with the Romans, let's say, but you can also look at slavery and the whole British and European involvement in the slave trade,
yeah,
and America, the West Indies, the Atlantic, and how, yeah. But also that it was a racialized slavery perhaps would come into focus there. Yeah. I think also you look at racism through, mm-hmm, through a number of lenses from this, but also, you know, the empires, the colonialists did create a sort of, you know, it's not race that created racism. It was racism that created race. You know, it's that way.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yes,
and yeah. that becomes important for people to know about. So I would teach all these things. Yeah.
I think that's a really, you know, really profound statement, that it's racism which led to races rather than the other way around. The other thing is, it's not easy, is it? Now, I've teaching of the empire now, I'm from a Pakistani background, obviously, you know, I would like my children, I've done that myself, but I would like children to be taught about the Indian Empire and the British Empire and Britain when it went to India and what happened. But everything I've seen, or quite a lot of what I've seen, again, it's perspective. It comes from one perspective, which perhaps is not telling the whole story. So how do we, if we start thinking of making a curriculum which will tell the story of the 1947 creation of Pakistan and India, how do we ensure that we are telling the whole story and we're not just using one perspective?
Yeah. The other thing, of course, that my heart goes out to history teachers is, is there's a lot of burden upon them.
Yes.
And hardly any lesson time.
Very true. Yes.
You've got to do all this and you've got an hour, yes, a fortnight or whatever, yeah, to do it in.
Yes.
And in some schools, it might be an hour or two a week or something, you know. And in some schools, it finishes at the end of year eight, you know.
Mm.
And then you have the majority of history teaching being done by primary school and 2 years in secondary, which is not enough to cover the subject fairly and well. Mm. So let's pretend that's not an issue. Let's pretend you've got all the time in the world and you can teach every topic in great detail. To me, this is the whole thing with the trivium, but you can hold two things or more together,
mm-hmm,
and they can be in opposition to each other. And you can teach them as though perhaps they're both true,
yeah,
or you teach those with equal credence.
Yeah.
And this is the teaching through dialectic. The idea that you teach through, you look at culture as a place that's not just one thing. It's a place where people disagree.
Yes.
And there are, you know, huge battles sometimes, and you teach about those different viewpoints from the viewpoint of, rather than just sort of stand back and tell a sort of overview of the whole thing, because the subjective views that people have matter, and that of course brings it alive. I don't mean tell lies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean tell untruths.
Yes.
But certainly perspectives tell their own truth about things.
Yeah.
And the whole story about India, you know,
yeah,
and the Indian subcontinent and the creation of Pakistan and Bangladesh obviously means a hell of a lot to some people.
Yeah.
More than others, perhaps. And that's of interest of itself, depending who's in your school.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be one person in your class who wants to know that story, or it could be the majority of people in the class who wants to know the story. Yeah. Or even if you then take out that sort of approach, saying, well, this is directly relevant, you also can talk about it from the fact that it should have import, even if it has nothing to do with your culture, apparently, your family, mm-hmm, or your background. And every time I say the word culture, by the way, I'm reminded that it doesn't necessarily come across in the way I intend it, because it depends on people's understanding of what culture is.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that was going to be one of my questions further on. We'll get onto that in a minute. I think what you've talked about is also one way to stop things being just a token. If we talk about from all perspectives, if we open it up to discussion, then it does, it perhaps may not become that tokenistic as it may be otherwise. Do you think that's a correct statement to make?
If you open things up to discussion, the important thing is that the discussions are based on knowledge.
Yes.
Rather than prejudice.
And, yes.
It's which is why it's important to look at different sides of things.
Right. Yeah.
people, again, I've seen this a lot in schools because I go in as a consultant and watch school discussions, classroom discussions. And a lot of the time, a teacher will ask a pupil their opinion. And a lot of the time, I feel this is being done too early.
Mm-hmm.
And the child is giving their opinion based on their own prejudice.
Right.
Which, you know, if you're talking about, did you like this piece of music? No, it's rubbish. You know, it just sort of closes down discussion straight away. Or, you know, did you like this sonnet? No, it's rubbish. You know, people or you know, and I've seen topics, you know, quite sensitive topics being discussed in PSHE about whether it be race or sexuality or whatever. And people just, some pupils throwing their prejudice into the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't necessarily sit well. And I think we need to examine the different sides of the argument and get kids to think and write essays and write speeches and all these things and get involved in having empathy or understanding for more than one side of the argument, more than just their side. So this is the classic thing you do is of course halfway through the class discussion everyone has to change sides, you know, things like that that mm-hmm. they can really get involved. So the only thing in the classroom should be is informed opinions
mm-hmm.
or educated opinions,
mm-hmm.
not just opinion. So that becomes an important part of it. And particularly if you're talking about, let's say you've got kids who in the classroom who perhaps are Muslim, who are Hindu, who are on different sides of the divide
mm-hmm.
In Pakistan, India, and then talk about, is it Kashmir? And you know, you can see that you could stir up something quite easily
yes.
if you wanted to, for no apparent reason.
through ignorance. Yeah.
Well, I mean, every teacher is ignorant of something.
Yes.
You know, and sometimes in certainly in PSHE, things will come up which aren't necessarily in the teacher's knowledge boundaries, you know, within their what they are comfortable with, perhaps discussing.
Well, again, going back to the 14th of August, there was a hashtag trending, which was Remembrance of Horrors of Partition Day, 14th of August. Now, if a teacher were to say, let's mark 14th August as the horror remembering day, and if you've got a child with the Pakistani heritage on there, that's not going to go down that well. So I think you need to know things. Right. We're going to take a short break. We're going to go to the news desk for the latest education news with Megan Goods. So if Martin, you hang around, and everybody just we'll have a listen to the news and we'll be right back.
creative resources made for teachers by teachers. At Creative Resources, we've been rethinking what a classroom can be. We've created a huge range of more than 2,500 original and exciting resources that span across more than 15 different subject areas. Whether you're looking for primary or secondary level resources, careers options, PSHE, arts or humanities, Creative Resources have the resources for you. We offer full curriculum packages and unique challenging escape rooms themed on topics such as Shakespeare, Tudors and fractions. We have quizzes, task cards, Tarsia puzzles and lots more. Better still, more than 100 resources can be accessed for free. Just visit our website www.creativeresources.com. You can get 10% off any order you make on our website by using the discount code TT Radio. Creative resources made for teachers by teachers. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. teacherslovestationery.club. This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Megan Goods.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News. A new report published in The Guardian this week has highlighted a rise in extremist views and conspiracy theories amongst pupils in England. Interviewers from UCL's Institute of Education interviewed teachers, 50% of whom said they had heard far-right views expressed in their classrooms. 90% had also heard vaccine-related conspiracy theories. 75% had heard Islamophobic or misogynistic views, and almost all of the interviewed staff had heard racist language in school. The report comes as 13% of terrorism-related arrests in the last financial year were of those aged 18 or under, up from 5% on the previous year. Young people under 24 also made up almost 60% of extreme right-wing terror arrests. Oakwood High School, a West London secondary, is rolling out a series of socialisation lessons to help students following the pandemic restrictions. The sessions will include sitting students together at lunch, bonding activities, and extracurricular clubs to help students find like-minded friends. Students will also be offered counselling if they need support with their mental health, and a buddy from an older year group. The head, Mr. Cowling, said, "As a school and community, we must do all we can to help our young people get back on the right track, both emotionally, socially, and academically." That was your latest Teachers Talk Radio News.
Live from London, this is The Late Show with Noreen Khalid on Teachers Talk Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back, Martin.
Hello. Am I here?
Yes, yes. You're back. Lovely. Shakespeare. He's a dead white man, isn't he? Should we stop teaching him?
Now, no. Next.
Right.
I don't think the issue is about taking things out of the curriculum. Mm-hmm. But saying that, then you've got to have the pragmatic side of what, you know, how much can there be in a curriculum? I wouldn't think that Shakespeare would come out of anybody's English curriculum.
Okay.
Because of the subject itself,
mm-hmm.
the importance of Shakespeare to it and to subsequent writers, and also to the way his work has influenced others. He's quite a gauge. The same with, you know, a book like the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
You could make an argument that that should be something that is taught as a piece of literature, but also as a cultural artifact to which many things refer to. And therefore, it has its place. Now, I don't know if the Bible is taught that much. It might be taught in RE. I don't think it's taught that much in English classes, but yeah. Perhaps it should be, could be. And that, of course, is not the work of dead white men, as far as I'm aware.
Right. So now that brings us to culture. So what is culture and who decides what's included? Now, it's easy to say that, you know, Mozart, it's culture, but it's gimme, gimme, gimme culture.
Yeah, everything's culture. I mean, this believe it or not, this conversation is culture. So what is culture is something which I suppose first came to people's notice through Matthew Arnold. This is where Matthew Arnold is quite a key figure in culture. But he sort of attached it to two things, one of which is a certain level of artifact and texts and paintings and what you could call high culture. And he tied it to those things and then also gave it the epithet of being able to create sweetness and light, being able to do good.
Mm-hmm.
That if you were touched by this sort of culture, you would be a better person and less likely to be anarchic and a danger. And the whole problem at the time, I think there were riots going on when he was writing it, and he was sort of looking at the anarchy in I think London, I honestly can't remember, and trying to say, well, what you need is what these young people need is a bit of culture that will sort them. And and then culture, of course, is then taken on by various others, by Leavis. And we have the great books, you know, this is the great books. You read these things, you will be an educated person. And then we could end up with cultural literacy, you know, with the E.D. Hirsch list of 5,000 things that every American should know. Or we get a different view of culture, which goes through people like Richard Hoggart, Raymond Williams, Stuart Hall. And that is an idea of culture as a place where you make meaning, where we commune together, where we share together. And that's kind of what I mean when I say culture.
Mm-hmm.
And culture is conversation, culture is paintings, yes, right. It's football, yes, it's food, it's everything we do that is sort of in the world, if you like. Right. It's our way of making meaning in the world,
right.
Both individually and together. And obviously it's also the ways of making some people an in-group and an out-group and all these other things that go on, because I like Spurs, you know, and you like mm-hmm. Arsenal, and therefore mm-hmm. you're liking the wrong team. And, you know, we can get into various messes with culture. So culture is something that can create tension as well as something that can create conversation. You know, it can create difficulties for everyone. But it's how human beings live in the world. It's how we make sense of the world. And to some extent, it's also how we view the world, even of science, of objectivity, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, go on.
Well, just while we were talking, we've had a message from TSCW, who recognized the ABBA reference and texted in ABBA, and they have now won the cup and the badge.
There you go. You see, so we have an ABBA reference. And is that high culture or low culture? But it's something that used to be ABBA for various people would have been the epitome of the most kitsch, most popular in a sort of derogatory way type of music. And now it's almost reaching a different layer. You know, people are appreciating, you know, you have the Times, you know, talking about how good ABBA are. Right. Now this is a different world we live in to the world of Matthew Arnold. But it's also different to Bourdieu and the idea of cultural capital. It's a very different world we live in. Culture is, you know, because of technology as well, is so available to people, whether it's conversation that we're having now. I'm doing this through my phone, you're somewhere else. People, you know, all three people are listening to it around the country or whatever, or picking it up later.
We've got listeners in listening in from Ghana. Would you believe it?
And there you go. So people everywhere, and this is technology, you know, and it's sort of making lots of cultural artifacts available to people that weren't, which were rarer, and only available to very rich people in the past. You know, so that's also a part of a leveling out of culture.
Tom Rogers thinks ABBA is high culture, Martin.
Well, I think it's difficult to argue about high culture and low culture now. Uh-huh. I think there are things that I would recognise as high culture. Let's say, you know, going to the Royal Opera House to see La Bohème, perhaps that's high culture. But in Italy, you know, you might consider it as part of their more popular culture, you know, particularly if you go to Verona and sit in the arena there and watch opera there. So there's, and what about Bob Dylan? That's the usual one people sort of get angst ridden about. Is he high culture or low culture? Is it popular culture, folk culture? How do these things, you know, and it's all change. Culture changes. It's not static. And because it's, you know, human beings are involved. So I haven't got so much in common with a 16th century person who was English as I have. I've got far more in common with you, you know, and you are someone, I'm someone who is white, the person who in the 16th century we are accepting or pretending was also white. Don't know, but let's say they were. But I have more in common with you because of the age in which we live. So it's culture is something that's very difficult to pin down, and it's something Raymond Williams actually called one of the most complex words in the English language because it covers so many things.
Well, exactly. Again, I had one of my questions following on from the ABBA reference was, how does one decide that ABBA is culture, but Achy Breaky Heart may not be culture?
Why not? Why are you damning country music? You know, I've got to sing it now. It's one of my favourite karaoke ones. No.
Well, mine too, actually.
Yeah.
I quite like it. Yes. Yeah.
Now the thing you need to perhaps raise here is everything equally good? Mm-hmm. And that becomes more difficult. because I do believe some things are better than other things.
Yeah.
But what those things might be are very difficult to arrive at.
Right.
But we can make assumptions, and some of those assumptions are based on our own particular perspective.
Okay.
So, look, I think the Taliban banning women taking part in sport is a bad thing.
Yeah.
Now, is there an argument that it isn't a bad thing? Well, there is clearly an argument that it isn't a bad thing. But from my perspective, that is a bad thing.
Thanks.
And from a number of women, and I think not all women in Afghanistan, but a number of women are obviously thinking along the same lines as me. They would agree with me on that. But some would suggest perhaps it is good. Yeah. So when we get, and it could be, well, you know, I'm over there, I am some sort of white guy in England making this sort of liberal argument, whereas a woman in Afghanistan who, you know, perhaps she has a different perspective. But who's right, who's wrong? What's best, what isn't?
Okay.
These arguments can go on all the time. But is everything relative? That's the question. Is it all relative? And I don't believe it is. I think some things are better than others, but it's very difficult necessarily to try and eke it out. But I would say Achy Breaky Heart generally is not as good as Beethoven's Third Symphony.
Mm-hmm. That brings me to my next question. No, I agree with you that although I like Achy Breaky Heart, and I have been known to wind my car windows down and sing at the top of of my voice to the horror of other people in the car, but I would agree with that too.
Well, then actually, Achy Breaky Heart, is it as good as Johnny Cash?
Mm.
And let's say Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire.
Yes.
I'd say Ring of Fire is classic, but so is Achy Breaky Heart. Put it into context of when it is being heard, who's it being heard by, who is it meant for, when is it meant for, and you get different sort of ideas, but you have your personal taste to it, and then you have a sort of general accepted we taste, the taste that we decide as a society. Now, that might be connoisseurs, those who really go to the Grand Old Opry, you know, and Nashville acolytes, you know, and them, or those of us who buy CDs or whatever and write a review underneath the CD on Amazon or whatever it happens to be. Culture is a place of discussion, of conflict, of and also borrowing and appropriation sharing, if you like. And music is a really good example of, and a very good example of why it's difficult to say that's better than that, and what should be in a curriculum and what shouldn't. So the classic thing is Stormzy or Mozart in music terms, but.
So
it's an interesting point.
Mozart, Beethoven, you know, or opera. Do you think that there might be a danger if we emphasize this too much, we are actually making people think that they must like this in order to appear cultured? But if they
to be cultured to. And this goes back, and we could talk about this in terms of cultural capital.
Yes.
Or you could talk about this in terms of snobbery.
Yes, that's the one I had there as well, yes.
But what is cultured, a cultured person? Well, I'm trying to sort of make it clear that everyone is encultured. Everyone is cultured.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to me, what a school should be doing is enabling people to be culturally mobile, to move within different spheres and different places, so where they can commune with scientists and historians and go to an art gallery and go to the opera and go to the O2 for the country festival. You know, whatever it happens to be, you should open up worlds to students that they can then dip their toe in a bit and perhaps go a bit further in these various worlds, which is why subjects are important, mm-hmm. because they give you this sort of parameters. I've just seen some lightning in the sky. Oh, my goodness. I think it's going to be a storm. So you might hear some claps of thunder in a bit. I might have to close the window. In a room here. So you want to open out the world that so children can get involved in the cultural conversations. They can find themselves culturally mobile and able to decide whether that is good or that is not so good, or, you know, what culture is to them, and take part in the arguments and discussions about it.
So culturally mobile. Now, I and my husband, when he wasn't my husband, we were both living in England, but we both went back because our families, both sets of families, were in Karachi, in Pakistan. So when we got married, we went back to Pakistan. It was easier for the two of us to go there rather than bring all the families over here to get married. Some of my friends who were working with me at the John Innes in Norwich, I invited them to the wedding and they kindly came along. What they did was, for one or two of the functions, they went out and bought Pakistani clothes to wear. Now, is that so? You could say they were becoming culturally mobile, they were appreciating it, but somebody else may accuse them of appropriation. So how do we navigate this, being culturally mobile, or are we appropriating somebody's culture?
I'm a believer in cultural hybridity. Mm-hmm. I think you can't close things off from people, but you've also got to go with the culture is making meaning of the time in which you're in. It's very sensitive to time. You know, I mean, Van Gogh was not popular in his lifetime, but after he died, his paintings became popular, you know, and things like that. Things, Bernard Manning wouldn't be, I was going to say, actually, it's Roy Chubby Brown, isn't it? It's finding it difficult to get a gig in Sheffield. Yeah. So comedy is something that is, you know, of its time sometimes, you know, and finds it very difficult to move in different times. But in Roy Chubby Brown's case, you know, you have to be, so it's two things. It's a sort of double consciousness going on. There's the consciousness of the person themselves, but then there's also the way that people look at that person. So if I would like to say, I don't know the people you're talking about. I don't know the situation. Mm-hmm. I would like to say, in all freedom, to express yourself in the way you'd want to. I would think it's perfectly all right to, but I don't know the situation. I can talk about another situation, which was Adele, mm-hmm. who I think, was it 2019 or 2020? I think it was 2020, because it was over the time of lockdown or the end of, it was the Notting Hill Carnival that wasn't. And she dressed in certain clothes that were carnival clothes, which she'd probably been doing before, you know.
Yeah.
But it got onto Twitter, you know, and she was told off for cultural appropriation. And lots of people said, but this is carnival, you know, this is what people do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So people saying from the outside what they think, and you shouldn't be doing that because that's not for you to wear. Now, for me, if you don't have cultural appropriation, you don't have cultural communication. In fact, you stop culture. Yeah. So let's go with going back to Achy Breaky Heart, let's go into perhaps popular music. And if we think of, I don't know if you know Paul Gilroy's book, The Black Atlantic, but he talks there about how the Atlantic is a sort of fluid place of ideas that go across. Some are bad, some are good. And you know, and obviously one of the bad things that went across the Atlantic is the slave trade. But also with that, you had America. and into the American melting pot, I'm going to use that term, of Irish, Scottish, Black African, religious people as well, you know, going together and creating a strange, different sorts of music, which became the blues, which became, you know, rock and roll, which became gospel music, which became all these sorts of things, which then found their way back across the Atlantic to places, notably Liverpool. And, you know, whether it be Lonnie Donegan, but then the Beatles and various others. Lonnie Donegan, more Irish, but got connections there. And created popular music, you know. So out of this cultural appropriation, cultural mixing, hybridity, cultural hybridity, we create new places of discussion, of conversation, of resistance, and some of it, you know, and high commercialization as well. So, you know, capitalism does well about out of it, but also protest songs and all these other things that go on. And if you don't appropriate, you don't get any of that.
You
don't get the Beatles. You don't get Elvis Presley. You don't get Johnny Cash. You don't get Tammy Wynette, Dolly Parton. But you also don't get Aretha Franklin. You also don't get Otis Redding, you know, and you don't get Stormzy in the end, you know. You have to allow these things to happen, but beware that there are cultural sensitivities at different times at different places. You know,
well, in the case which I talked about, my friends, we were very happy for them to have dressed up. We thought it was a mark of respect that they wanted to blend in with us, and I, in fact, had taken them shopping. They, you know, to places where they could buy something, and not a single person who attended the wedding minded that, and everybody sort of appreciated that.
And that matters, you know.
That matters, yes.
If you know, and the way of dressing, you know, it's like if you go to a certain wedding and they say you've had morning suits, you know, that to me is culturally alien. I've never worn a morning suit, you know. It's a class thing as well, that gets tied into these things. Perhaps it's a way of saying we are like this, or, you know, but for people who, to perhaps if I turned up in jeans, which I tend to wear at a place where it said morning suits, people might think of that as rude. Because I'm not dressing in the intended or accepted way. But I don't know what it said on the invites, of course, in the case you're talking about. But I you obviously know a lot more about that than me. I think it sounds fine to me.
It was fine. It was.
If you say it's fine, then it's fine.
It was right. Thank you. We'll take a quick break again for the news. We'll be right back.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Megan Goods.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News. A new report published in The Guardian this week has highlighted a rise in extremist views and conspiracy theories amongst pupils in England. Interviewers from UCL's Institute of Education interviewed teachers, 50% of whom said they had heard far-right views expressed in their classrooms. 90% had also heard vaccine-related conspiracy theories. 75% had heard Islamophobic or misogynistic views, and almost all of the interviewed staff had heard racist language in school. The report comes as 13% of terrorism-related arrests in the last financial year were of those aged 18 or under, up from 5% on the previous year. Young people under 24 also made up almost 60% of extreme right-wing terror arrests. Oakwood High School, a West London secondary, is rolling out a series of socialisation lessons to help students following the pandemic restrictions. The sessions will include sitting students together at lunch, bonding activities, and extracurricular clubs to help students find like-minded friends. Students will also be offered counselling if they need support with their mental health, and a buddy from an older year group. The head, Mr. Cowling, said, "As a school and community, we must do all we can to help our young people get back on the right track, both emotionally, socially, and academically." That was your latest Teachers Talk Radio News.
Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. At Creative Resources, we've been rethinking what a classroom can be. We've created a huge range of more than 2,500 original and exciting resources that span across more than 15 different subject areas. Whether you're looking for primary or secondary level resources, careers options, PSHE, arts or humanities, Creative Resources have the resources for you. We offer full curriculum packages and unique challenging escape rooms themed on topics such as Shakespeare, Tudors and fractions. We have quizzes, task cards, Tarsia puzzles and lots more. Better still, more than 100 resources can be accessed for free. Just visit our website www.creativeresources.com. You can get 10% off any order you make on our website by using the discount code TT Radio. Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club. Introducing the Leadership Masterclass.
Welcome back. So we are talking with Martin Robinson. We've talked about culture and decolonizing the curriculum, which now takes us to curriculum. Martin, Pakistan has started introducing a national curriculum. Their argument is that in a country like Pakistan, the difference between someone going to a private fee-paying school and a state school is so great that there needs to be a common base of knowledge which everyone can have access to. And I can sort of see the merit of this argument if I compare HSN College, a fee-paying school where Imran Khan, the Prime Minister, went, and a village school in Inner Sindh, as this difference is much greater than that between Eton and Harrow and a coastal village in Norfolk. So should education systems around the world have national curricula?
It's a lovely question. First of all, can we address the difference between private and state education? Because that gives us some way of the answer, even if everyone was learning exactly the same thing. You know full well that those in the private schools would be learning something on top, or else they wouldn't bother paying for it. And it might be to do with who goes to that school. It might be which families send people to that school. Again, it's, knowledge is not just what you're taught. It's who you're with. And various, you can't take the context away. They might go home in a Ferrari in the holidays, you know, rather than a bicycle or whatever. There's the thunder.
Yeah.
Can you hear it? Can you hear it?
Yeah.
I've got to time controversial things to say and then crack a thunder or something like that just afterwards would be rather good. It's difficult to say that everyone should therefore learn the same things. I mean, what they could do, of course, is abolish private schools and teach everyone the same thing. And then that might be more like teaching everyone the same thing. But even then, there will be differences. But anyway, I don't think you can just teach the same things. I mean, it's like art. Mm-hmm. Does everyone just know the same art? Does everyone know the same music? Does everyone know the same history? And bearing in mind how limited you have to be in curriculum time anyway, when you teach those things, it's very difficult, very limiting. But there are things that subjects should teach, which perhaps are more, I've got to use the word universal advisedly, things like what is a poem, what is a novel, what is a play, what's tragedy, what's comedy, you know, certain things that perhaps underpin other bits of knowledge. This is more obvious in subjects like maths and science than what these things might be, might be in the arts, but it's still there. There are general things which belong in a breadth, in the breadth of the subject, that perhaps you could teach generally. But those would be decided within subjects and professionals making those choices. And I don't see that a national curriculum has much substance in that case. Where it does have substance and where it is, of course, in nation building. And this is what British values are about over here. So I don't know if Pakistani values are going to be part of that. But also, I think North Korea, China, I think China's socialist values is part of it. They've just re-established what should be taught in Chinese schools. And this is where I get very nervous about nation building and curriculum, because it tends towards the idea that we are great. We have the best history, we have the best literature, we have the best art, we're so magnanimous here that we can see that other people have quite good art as well, but not as good as ours, really. Right. So I find it difficult, this argument, because I do think home, tradition, the people who live together in a space matter. And that those relationships matter, and that's not just to each other, but also to the land, to the place where they live, to the environment. And whether that's just picking up litter or appreciating the beauty of the landscape, or, you know, thinking about it, the environment and the importance of environment. then that does matter. But obviously certain things will be taught which help you settle in the space where you live generally, and therefore in England, the English language is obviously an important one. General things about finding your way around the space in which you're in. So local geography is important. Understanding how we got here. So perhaps local history and what local is a difficult thing to gauge, you know. But I do get a bit worried when people start saying, well, a national curriculum.
Yeah.
And it's become normal here, but it's only been normal since 1988.
Right.
And even then, I think if you look at what France used to do, I'm not sure if they still do, but, you know, if it was Tuesday, the 28th of whatever, in France, every school would be teaching the same thing on that day. And I don't know whether that's a good thing.
Right. That's
What do you think? Do you think it's a good thing?
Well, like I said, looking at
Pakistan is huge as well. I mean,
it's huge, but Pakistan has really different sort of problems because there are kids who will be going just to the madrasa, will be just learning to read the Quran and nothing else. And therefore, if you made it mandatory on these madrasas to teach a bit of maths, a bit of English, a bit of Urdu, or the regional language, a bit of Sindhi or Punjabi or whatever, at least that child then has a little bit more capability of, you know, joining in the work market or job market and making something of themselves. So I think I can see an argument for it in Pakistan, but I haven't looked at the curriculum.
But that's not necessarily an argument for a national curriculum. It is for a broad and rich curriculum. And you could say that every school must offer a broad and rich curriculum. And you could sort of, I suppose, make various assumptions about what is broad and rich within those parameters, and certain things that should be included. But, you know, I mean, if you in this country are just listening to the news section about far right extremism in this country, if you know, there might be a teacher in a school teaching far right extremist propaganda. Or hyper religious propaganda, or, you know, and there have been cases of that in this country, and you would want perhaps the job of an Ofsted or people like that to say, well, you can't teach certain things, and you must teach certain things in a broader sense of the word. I mean, it's interesting what we're talking about with decolonization. Earlier that I think it's Kemi Badenoch was talking about just trying to think what she said, critical race theory, and she was saying in the House of Commons that if a school taught critical race theory as fact, she would class that as breaking the law, and that law would come down on the school. Or defunding the police as well, without offering the balanced of opposing views, you know. So it could be that certain things are in law. It doesn't mean it's a national curriculum, though.
True. I'm going to take a short ad break. When I come back, there are two questions. I'm shortly going to be running out of time, but two questions, which are really big questions, but... I'll let you think over that while I play the ad. The first one is, what is a broad and balanced curriculum? And the second is, what is the purpose of education? So I'll play the ad while you think, gather your thoughts on this.
Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE-validated programmes to help you? Read, Write, Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics.
Hello, welcome back.
Hello.
So we've got, we've just got somebody joining us from Palestine. Hello, Moshe. Welcome to the show. And Tom Rogers thinks these are really two easy questions of which I've asked you. So let's get down to it.
I've got to go with the purpose of education one first,
right.
Because
okay.
I'm going to use the James Baldwin quote, which is the purpose of education is to create in a person the ability to look at the world for himself, to make his own decisions, to say to himself, this is black or this is white. And this is the way he achieves his own identity. Now, obviously, he's using masculine language there, but his, her idea. But that to me sort of sums it up, really, that education is to free the individual, to help them find their way in the world and to meet others within that, mm-hmm. both in subjects or areas of interest or human beings with which to partake the journey, you know, mm-hmm. to find themselves, if you like. So you can find yourself in various subjects, but in various people and shared interests and shared culture, if you like. So it opens it up to be free and free of their teacher as well, of course, mm. and not beholden to them forever, you know, that you're always agreeing with them. I think Saint Augustine said something about this, about freeing the individual from the teacher, you know, to not just repeat the teacher's views for the rest of their time, you know, that's not an education. So freedom, education for freedom, easy. What's broad and balanced? No idea what I mean. Broad is, again, these are culturally specific at certain times, so these are going to change and at different times and be perhaps in different environments. But generally, arts, humanities, physical exercise, languages, technical subjects. I've probably missed something very important there. The sciences, that's what I've missed out. You know, yeah, no science. So to have a general sort of way of seeing the world in those different compartments, and within that, what should be studied within those, well, as broad as you can make it. Balance is having that balance right, and I don't think we get this right all the time, because mm-hmm. we tend to think of two things, utility and utopia. We think of these things far too much. What job people might get, and how to make the world better. And those two distortions, you know, we've already talked about the national idea of what the better world might be in China, for example, or the Taliban might think of the better world, you know. So I always find utopian arguments rather worrying. Mm. And utilitarian ones I also find worrying, because how do you, if you teach people towards a jobs market, then what are you saying education is for? Well, it's not for freedom. It's for service to mammon. You know, that's not a good way for an education to go.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Martin. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a great honour.
Oh, no, honour's all mine, actually. I'm going to get you back one day, because I've wanted to talk to you about your books. So maybe we'll have to leave that for another day. But this conversation got so interesting that that I never got around to my questions about Athena and the Machine or Trivium 21C.
Who wants to advertise my books? I don't mind. People can buy them if they wish or leave them if they wish.
But thank you so much. It's been a pleasure and it's been really illuminating and I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. And again, thank you for taking time out of your Wednesday night to come and join us here.
Had I known it was the same time as the football, I might not have done it.
I'm glad you didn't twink on that.
Take care.
Very good. Thanks ever so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.